Today, I'm going to talk about school vouchers, which is an economic reform for the education system. The basic idea of a voucher is to give money to students rather than to schools. So instead of having tax revenue go directly to schools, the money, let's say if the school system spends on average $10,000 per student, the $10,000 would go to parents, not to spend however they want, but as what's called a voucher. So when they choose a school for their student, then the $10,000 goes to that school, but only when the school is chosen. The idea is to give parents more choice with where they go to school or how they use public money to go to school. So vouchers is often called the school choice proposal. This idea is was designed by economists because economists were trying to come up with ways to bring a more market-oriented approach to schooling and to funding schools. The idea of putting money in the hands of parents in the form of vouchers rather than to schools is to try to create a situation where education is still subsidized by the voucher, but otherwise a market prevails because instead of being told you must go to a certain school if you want to be subsidized, namely the local public school, you have the choice of taking your voucher to any school that you want to send your student. What we've seen in the United States so far are a few voucher experiments. There's a famous one in Milwaukee. There's one starting in the district. So these are very small, usually in very troubled school districts, small experiments with vouchers. What economists would like to see is really a nationwide voucher system with all vouchers. And you know, people sort of wonder how that will work. There's often a typical comment is, well, there are not enough private schools. So how could vouchers possibly work? How could we go to an all-voucher system? And the answer is that if you were to go next fall to an all-voucher system where where parents received the money and then had to choose which school to spend it on, then at that moment every school would be a private school, and the existing public schools would then have to compete with existing private schools, and eventually things would settle out, and we'd know, which schools draw enough students and which schools don't. One description of how a full voucher system would work is in the chapter of the book, in my book, Learning Economics, a chapter called Efficiency, Entrepreneurship, and Education. And here's how I formulated, and this was a few years ago. I was looking at Montgomery County Public Schools as an example of public schools, and I was looking at Sandy Spring Friends School, which is a private school there, as an example of a private school. And so these figures are a few years old, and I know the cost per student definitely in Montgomery County has shot way up since then. But at the time, the cost per student in Montgomery County was about $8,000. Each teacher had about 30 students in the classroom. And so I multiplied students per teacher times cost per student to get a figure of revenue per teacher. Again, I'm thinking like an entrepreneur, and I'm thinking of key ratios. Revenue per teacher is going to be a key ratio. And it was $240,000, just multiplying 30 students times $8,000 per student. And I estimated that the pay per teacher was about $80,000. I think that's actually a radical overestimate of what teachers get paid in Montgomery County. I was trying to include all the health care, retirement benefits, all in costs. So that's compensation. It's not take home pay. But I still think I overshot. But what I noticed when I did this calculation was the huge amount of overhead per teacher. 160,000, basically double the teacher's pay. And I calculate overhead by just by looking at the difference between revenue and pay per teacher. So what does that overhead go to? Some of it's capital costs, some of the cost of school buses, but a lot of it is the cost of bureaucracy. There are just tons and tons of cluster coordinators and curriculum specialists and just non-teaching staff just overloading the school system. And if you want to know why it costs so much to put a teacher into a classroom, it's because of all that overhead, and that overhead consists primarily of non-teaching faculty. And I've had that view confirmed by a guy who was a superintendent in the Denver school systems, that the amount of non-teaching staff is just enormous, and that's what drives the cost up. Okay, so then we look at I looked at Sandy Spring Friends School as an example of a private school. Cost per student is higher. The number of students per teacher is much lower. So when you put it together, the revenue per teacher is actually lower. They pay their teachers less, but overall the overhead per teacher is a lot less. And in a way, that's puzzling because the private school doesn't have nearly what economists call the economies of scale. That is, you would think that a larger school district would have lower overhead because you only need one school principal. You only need one superintendent. You shouldn't need as many administrators per student to run a large school system as you do a small private school. But you actually find the opposite, that the overhead is higher in the public school system. Again, that's this phenomenon that I noticed of lots of non-teaching staff in the public school system, whereas the private schools have very few non-teaching staff. And then I talk about moving to a voucher system. And I'm guessing that a $10,000 cost per student, we go to 15 students per teacher, not as low as in a small private school, but still much lower than the public schools, so for a revenue per teacher of $150,000. In order to do that, you would have to hire a lot more teachers than we have today. So I'm assuming that the pay per teacher would have to go up, and that's where I get that $90,000 figure. And then I'm figuring about 60,000 in overhead per teacher, and that's because I think that we could have the advantages of public schools, that is, you would have economies of scale, that you wouldn't have to have one high school principal for some of these private high schools have only a couple hundred students. You could have better scale, larger scale schools. Which would reduce overhead, but I think the overhead could also be reduced quite a bit from the public schools because you wouldn't have to have as much non-teaching staff. Now, what forces would lead to that? I guess I'm assuming that competition would drive out that overhead. So a key assumption that I'm making in my article on efficiency, entrepreneurship, and education is that overhead per teacher would be driven down by the forces of competition. That is, as parents select better schools, they'll be selecting schools with a, they would prefer to see teachers, their money paying for teachers rather than for the non-teaching staff, the hidden bureaucrats that pad the payroll in the public school system today. Parents would be reluctant to pay for that, and they would tend to choose schools that steer away from that and therefore reduce overhead. Okay, so that's kind of my picture of where how schools might evolve in a voucher system. Sort of a vision of what a voucher system might lead to. Now, one criticism that people make of vouchers is that if everybody gets $10,000, then rich people will supplement their $10,000 voucher with their own money and put their kids in the best private schools, and poor people won't be able to supplement, and they'll be stuck in the least extravagant private schools. So a solution for that is what I call underneath the table progressive vouchers. And that's been proposed by Robert Reich, who was the Secretary of Labor under President Clinton. He proposed it after Clinton left office because vouchers is a dangerous word among Democrats. I'll explain why in a minute. But the idea of progressive vouchers is that the size of the voucher would increase as income goes down. So low-income people would get higher vouchers than high-income people. So a wealthy person might get a voucher of only a token voucher of a few thousand dollars. Poor person might get a voucher of $15,000 or $20,000. This is described in this chapter, also in the book, called Equity, Entrepreneurship, and Education. So you'd have low-income students getting higher vouchers. Also, you'd have to do something for students with learning disabilities, because if in a purely private system with a one voucher fits all, schools won't want to teach students with learning disabilities because they cost a lot and they're getting, you know, the same voucher. So what I have to do to implement a full voucher system is come up with provisions that increase the voucher, the amount that goes to someone to a student with learning disabilities. So that would be probably the most bureaucratically difficult thing about progressive vouchers, would be coming up with the rules that say, given this, if you're tested for this learning disability and found to have this learning disability, you get, you know, $2,000 more in a voucher, something like that. Another potential problem with vouchers, one that I worry about, is the problem of a segregation equilibrium. That is, suppose people have no idea really what the value added is on schools. Remember in the last lecture, and if you are just jumping in here, go back to the last lecture, when I talked about the problem of measuring value added in schools. And if people have no idea what the real value added is, and they just evaluate schools based on, let's say, average SAT scores, without thinking about to what extent the school is raising the SAT scores versus the fact that the students coming in happen to be better students to begin with. So if people are not measuring value added and they're just looking at reputations of schools based on indicators that aren't really accurate, then there could be a segregation equilibrium. That is, rich people will supplement their vouchers to pay to have students be in the schools with good reputations. And poor people won't be able to afford, even with the voucher, to get into the schools with a good reputation. So a good reputation school might cost $25,000 a year. The voucher might be worth $10,000 a year. And so that you get this segregation equilibrium in which rich people send their kids to one set of schools and poor people send their kids to another. Now, again, I should emphasize that what we have today with public schools looks a lot like a segregation equilibrium. That is, rich people buy houses in expensive neighborhoods so that their kids go to the best public schools, and poor people are stuck in neighborhoods with poor public schools. So segregation equilibrium is not unique to a voucher system, and it might, in fact, be reduced by a voucher system, but I still think it's something to worry about. And so a couple of ways of dealing with that. One would be a luxury tax on high tuition schools so that the rich parents who want to send their students to the most exclusive schools would pay a tax. So let's say that if the tuition is over $20,000, you pay a 50% tax on the overage. So if you send your kid to a school with a $30,000 tuition, which is 10,000 over the 20,000 limit, then $5,000 of your tuition is taxed, and that $5,000 would go to poor people to sort of increase the size of their vouchers. Anyway, that's just a general description of a luxury tax. I don't know what the specifics ought to be, but the idea is that it would really penalize people who send their children to very high tuition schools, and that money in turn collected from those penalties would go to low-income children. So that's one approach to addressing a segregation equilibrium. Another approach is to offer better information on value added. That is, if you could capture better data on schools and measure their value added as opposed to less rigorous measures, then people would start to choose schools based on value added and not on reputation. And I think if that were true, I think there'd be less likely to be a segregation equilibrium because people would be choosing schools for the right reason. Okay, so who supports vouchers? Economists, first of all, because we like the idea of market discipline. Right now, the money that schools get has nothing to do with how effective they are. It just has to do with the tax base in the local community. And so there's no market discipline at all. There's no reward for better schools. There's no punishment for worse schools. And that's a source of extreme frustration for economists because economists believe in market discipline. They believe that success should be rewarded and failure should be punished by going out of business. And as I mentioned before, there's no such thing as a school going out of business. If schools that are as unpopular and as ineffective as some of the public schools are existed in the marketplace, they would go out of business. People would take their children away, they'd take their business away and move their business elsewhere. And that's the idea of school choice or voucher systems, is to allow people to take their business elsewhere. And when they take their business elsewhere, let the bad schools fail. So, you'll hear opponents of vouchers saying what vouchers would lead to is a lot of public schools go out of business. And if you're really an honest defender of vouchers, you say that's a virtue, not a defect of a voucher system. That is, having schools go out of business, if they're not working, if they're not satisfying the customers, is something that ought to happen in a market system. It's the way markets produce better products, is by having the better business succeed and the ineffective business fail. So again, so economists like the market discipline, and what I particularly noticed is this issue of overhead, that the public schools are really bloated with non-teaching staff. And I think it's unlikely that that non-teaching staff is worth what is paid for it. And in a competitive market, I believe that somebody who started a school and used the revenue for the school to pay for in-class teachers as opposed to out-of-class bureaucrats, I think that school would compete effectively, particularly if we had this better information on value added. So anyway, economists tend to be strong supporters of voucher systems. We believe that market discipline would be a good thing for schools. Some parents in failing schools are strong supporters of vouchers. The Milwaukee voucher system really came about because of the lobbying of parents. There was a parent group in Milwaukee that wanted a chance to take their children out of the failing schools and have the choice and have voucher systems. And so that's happening in some areas. Other supporters of vouchers include religious groups because, for example, Catholic schools, they feel like, well now we'd get more money to send our kids to Catholic schools. Okay, so opponents of vouchers, the strongest opponent is the teachers union because some of the private schools that could be supported by vouchers might not necessarily have unionized teachers. So it would be So vouchers might be against the interest of teachers' unions. Now, I don't think it would be against the interest of teachers because I think, as I put in my example, I think it would raise the demand for teachers, although it might end up raising the demand only for classroom teachers and lowering the demand overall in the education system. Think of it this way: if the non-teaching bureaucrats are, two things might happen to them under a voucher system. One is that they might lose their jobs altogether, or the other is they might be pulled back into the classroom. And in any case, that's something that the teachers' unions are concerned with and afraid of, and in general, they don't want to lose their power. So they're the strongest opponents of vouchers. Also, there are some anti-religious groups, as you call, or you might, they would probably, they certainly wouldn't call themselves that. They would call themselves, pro-separation of church and state, I guess they would put it. So people like People for the American Way, the American Civil Liberties Union, their point is that if you allow vouchers, then if a parent of a student in a religious school takes their $10,000 voucher and spends it on a religious school, then in a way the voucher is indirectly subsidizing religion and religious education, and that's kind of questionable in terms of the First Amendment, which says that the state will not establish a religion. So I won't get into the legal argument about whether that argument's right or not, but I'm just making the point that there are some groups who feel that separation of church and state requires that no government money go to support education in religious schools, even indirectly by vouchers. But anyway, the main takeaway from the lecture is that I think the reason that economists support vouchers is that economists believe that market discipline leads to improvement and efficiency. And if you look at this table that I put up, it's an indication of what I think the possibilities for efficiency are. I think you could reduce the student-teacher ratio and yet pay teachers more money, pay classroom teachers more money by reducing the overhead, which consists to a large extent of non-teaching staff. And by reducing that non-teaching staff and instead using classroom teachers, you could have a more effective system. And I think the most likely route to get to that effective system would be a voucher system, which would allow market competition to drive out of business the schools with the bloated overhead and to lead to the creation and development of schools that are more efficient.